This is an ABC podcast.
Just a warning, this episode contains graphic accounts of sexual abuse. We've undergone a revolution in Australia over the past few decades in how we talk about many crimes. But despite the new openness, there is one crime that still remains very much taboo. Incestuous abuse is thought to be much more prevalent in Australia than many assume. But knowing how to talk about it and about the condition it can trigger, dissociative identity disorder, is beyond the experience of most of us. I'm Stephen Smiley, and today on The Signal, we're sitting down with reporter Tracy Shelton from the ABC's Background Briefing program to hear about the pattern of this type of crime and about how its victims survive it. Tracy, can we get you to introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Tracy Shelton. I work with the Asia Pacific Newsroom for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation.
Yeah. Now, in your role at the ABC and before that, Tracy, you've travelled all over the place. You've spent time in the Middle East, and you came into the story that we're talking about today from kind of an unusual, perhaps an unexpected place. Can you just give us a sense about that?
Yes. Before I came back to Australia, I spent 12 years working overseas as a correspondent, mostly in the Middle East and working in war zones. And I'd seen a lot of trauma, a lot of extreme experiences that people had been through and how that affected people. And so when I came back to Australia, I was a little bit lost at first. I didn't really know what to do as a journalist here because I'd spent all these years talking to people who'd been through extreme trauma. And I didn't really know what to do with all that experience and knowledge that I had. So I started looking at the effects of trauma here in Australia, and I came across a really different group of people, but that were experiencing the same kinds of effects from trauma that I'd seen in war zones.
And where did you go with that line of inquiry? I mean, who were the experts that you kind of approached to try and understand this phenomenon?
When I started reaching out to people about this topic, a lot of people were pointing me towards Warwick Middleton, who was an expert in dissociative disorders and had dealt with many cases of extreme trauma here in Australia.
And that psychiatrist, Dr. Warwick Middleton, told Tracy about one particular client who made him realise he was dealing with something unusual. He says she had been diagnosed with a range of different conditions, but nothing seemed to be working. And then in the middle of a consultation, she just changed into what seemed to be a completely different person.
I was sitting with a patient who was perplexing, patient who had had multiple opinions about what her diagnosis was and had tried multiple different antidepressants and seemingly was going nowhere, remained dysphoric and distressed but couldn't understand what was happening to her. And then in my office, my phone rang and I just happened to have to speak to someone on the phone for a few seconds, and when I turned around, even I couldn't mistake the fact that she had completely transformed in that small moment from someone who was depleted and dysphoric into someone who'd suddenly presented as a happy party girl. And my first question to her at that point was, "And who are you?" And she said, "Oh, I'm Katie." My second question was, "Okay, and who are all the others?" And of course, she had DID.
And Warwick Middleton told Tracy the condition he was observing, DID, was related to but different from what you might know as dissociation.
Dissociation itself is something that we all do, especially when we have an unpleasant experience. We tend to put it aside in our mind. We put it away so that we can deal with our everyday life. But what Warwick Middleton was dealing with were the really extreme cases of this, and at the very highest level is what's known as dissociative identity disorder. What that is, it's a coping mechanism that develops in early childhood when a child is still going through the development stages and needs the love and support of caregivers around them. But if they're experiencing abuse from those, particularly from those caregivers, they can dissociate that abuse or lock it away into another part of their mind so that they can continue with their daily life.
Something like 80% of all of our patients, whether inpatients or outpatients, come with a history of childhood abuse.
They can continue with normal development. They can cope through things like schooling and the normal development processes. And they may even be sometimes unaware that that abuse is happening to them, or they may know that the abuse is happening, but they're dissociating the feelings and the effects of that abuse.
And so in working on this story, this background briefing story that's out this week, how many people have you spoken with who are living with this dissociative identity disorder, DID?
Well, here in Australia, I've spoken to around 40 people now who are living with DID.
And one of those people agreed to speak with you about the dreadful experiences that she had in her life. Can you tell us a little bit about Annie?
Yes. Well, Annie grew up in what she describes as a very violent household.
Well, my earliest memories were kind of structured, except the routine was bordered around violence. So discipline was extremely violent. So there were injuries quite often to all of us.
She says her parents were very abusive towards her and her brothers. But that abuse from her parents also left her vulnerable to abuse even from her siblings. And she describes sexual abuse by many of the men in her life, her father, her brothers, and even her grandfather.
I was open to being molested by my brothers. So I was in nappies. And my brothers had free rein over me. I was a toy. I had a grandfather who... my dad's dad, who also encouraged the boys in ways to be rough with me and was rough with me himself. And at some stage, he also mistreated me. So in a way, I'll just say it broadly, he molested me as well, but not to the degree that my brothers did and were allowed to do.
And in your conversation with Annie, you learned about the existence of some documentary evidence or some corroborating evidence about what she experienced. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, as an adult, she obtained a copy of her child services records, and it does detail extreme abuse. There's many records of hospitalizations and injuries that had occurred to her. There's reports of suspected abuse as well. Not everything in her story can be verified. There's a lot of information in there that's been redacted, but there's certainly enough to outline a terribly abusive childhood.
And at a young age, what kind of behaviours did Annie adopt in the face of what she's describing?
Her mind did something that's, I guess, unusual. She started what she calls splitting.
My first realization that I was maybe broken, a split, came about when I started stealing stuff and finding it in my room, hiding food as if I was hiding it for someone else. And it became a thing where, to protect myself, I had to pretend that I had someone else to take care for. So I'd hide food, I'd steal clothes, I'd steal lollies, I'd lie, I'd do all sorts of stuff to try and protect this almost imaginary person that was a concept that I didn't understand, but these behaviours I couldn't help.
So she was separating these experiences of abuse and the various different kinds of abuse from these different people into different sections of her mind. And so at times she wasn't even aware of what had just happened. She said she would find herself across town sometimes or in a place where she didn't remember going to, as different parts of her mind took control at different times.
I would end up halfway across town, not know how I got there. I would end up on top of buildings, not knowing. I wasn't able to keep myself safe at that time.
And Tracy, how long did Annie say this abuse within her own family went on for until she managed to get away?
Well, according to her files, at around the age of 12, she was handed over to child services and she was put into foster care.
I was there until the department got custody of me through the court. Mm-hmm. And then I was placed with foster family.
But she says that she still had some experiences of various unsavory characters during this time, and she would often run away. She was also very hard to handle. She was acting out, stealing. She herself says that she was very destructive, especially towards herself and her own possessions.
I was very destructive, especially to my own self and my own things and anything done for me, because I didn't think I deserved it.
So she was a very confused, very difficult to manage child, and she was bouncing between foster homes and childcare centres. Eventually, State Child Protection Services sent her to a government-run group home.
It was the last resort to give me any sense of what kids need in a safe way, you know, to try and give me structure, to try and get me into matriculation properly, going to school. And there were rules. It's a very structured place. And the staff were, you know, they were good.
Okay, Tracy, but even then, Annie told you that the abuse continued at the hands of her family, didn't she? And at one point she says that that happened when a mistake was made of some kind, right?
Yeah, so she was living in a childcare centre and she was sent back to visit her family. So the first part of the visit, she went to stay with her grandmother, who was a lovely woman.
Really beautiful lady. She did so much for me, helped me learn to cook, clean, everything, you know, that mum wasn't able to do.
But the second half, she was sent to stay with her father's parents, and one of her brothers, who she said had abused her throughout her childhood, also came to stay with them.
And then we were out there fishing, I think, or something, and we got back to the ramp. I wanted to go to the loo, so I went up to the bathroom. And my brother, I kind of believe that I went into another split of me or part of me, the part that coped with him abusing me when I was younger. I don't think I was all with it. It was almost like I changed into this person that just accepted that this is what was happening. And all of a sudden he's pulled me down on top of him and he's inside. And I kind of just, I don't know, I think I froze. I think I was frozen. But I felt like he knew in some way in his mind that he had a right to kind of go there with me again. I mean, after it occurred, I obviously ran out from him and, you know. And I remember the feeling of him chasing after me and me going, no, don't want to talk to you. I want to get back because I was scared. And that was probably my first real experience of being abused again after being taken out of the family that was abusing me.
And then sadly, that wasn't even the last time that she was abused, right?
Yeah, that's right. She said that after this, there was another incident where she was abused by a stranger. And for many years after that, she said her family would continue to seek her out and abuse her.
I mean, Tracy, it's just an awful pattern, and it seems when you first hear it to be kind of unbelievable, but is this story of, you know, like recurring incidents of abuse in different situations, is this as unusual as you might first think?
Actually, no, it's really common. And Dr. Middleton actually explained this to me when I met him.
You can see that these people are, on the one hand, you know, they want to be safe and to be loved, and on another level they're extraordinarily vulnerable to people picking up their vulnerability, grooming them and then abusing them.
Abuse, especially during childhood, leaves the child and then later on even the adult vulnerable to ongoing abuse from their original perpetrators but also from others as well.
Right from the very beginning it was apparent to me that a significant proportion of those highly dissociative individuals had backgrounds or were currently embroiled in scenarios where they were still continuing to be sexually abused by family members into their adult years. And in some cases, it was ongoing for decades.
It's very difficult for them to recognise red flags or dodgy behaviour of other people because that's all they've known through their whole life.
In a case like Annie's, what does Dr. Middleton say kind of needs to happen? What works?
Well, the first thing is to get them into a safe place, to get them away from the abuse, give them that power to break away from their family. And then it just takes a lot of years of therapy and work to get through working through that trauma and processing that trauma.
In regard to the compartments with DID, you get, you know, named identity states. They may represent, for example, a part that contains, you know, the memories of what father did. They may have another part that contains memories of what mother did. You know, some people may have, you know, identity states that are named after animals. Some people after characters from Doctor Who. Others, whereas it's very basic, you know, it's things like Mr. Angry. Guess what, you know, Mr. Angry carries.
And Warwick Middleton says the key is not necessarily the integration of parts, but just getting those parts to work together. He says that worked well in Annie's case, whom he treated, and in other people whose stories were like hers.
You know, the ones that do well, you know, I can't say they all stop dissociating, but they have it in a much more controlled manner, and they may still have parts, but the relationship between their parts, you know, has become much more cooperative.
I wouldn't say I fully don't fugue, dissociate.
Right.
But I have a much better way of handling it.
Right.
So it's possible, you know, that they've been able to compartmentalise their role and then come back to being a part of me. You know, Dr. Middleton, to this day, I say, is my saving grace. He helped me see that, no, you really don't deserve black or white. You deserve to be cared for. And he started the seed in me that, hey, it's not your fault. This is circumstance. This is abuse. This is wrong. And the part of me that kept telling me all the time to survive, to keep fighting, to look in, every time I looked in the mirror and I saw that girl and told her, stay strong, don't cry, don't break, don't let this break you, you've got to stay strong. He helped that seed grow into a plant.
I think it's fair to say, right, Tracy, that sort of long-term incestuous abuse is very rarely discussed in Australia. Why is that? And what do people who have, you know, investigated this in a law enforcement capacity, for example, have to say?
It's the kind of topic that people just don't want to talk about. They don't want to recognise that this is happening. Even if it's within their own family or within people that they know, they may see the signs. They may see this, they may see the signs that this is happening, but they don't want to accept that it's possible for someone that they know to do this thing to a child. And this is something that former Detective Senior Sergeant Chris O'Connor had talked to me about. He worked for 25 years with the Victoria Police Sex Crime Squad.
And Chris O'Connor told Tracy that siblings were involved in the majority of incest cases he dealt with, which he says is something parents simply don't want to think about.
Stranger Danger of itself was not a detrimental program. However, it was so single-focused, it turned a generation of people to believe that it could only happen with strangers. It's not uncommon for a mother to know or sense that something is happening, or indeed being told by a child at the time that something is happening and has not done anything to assist the child beyond perhaps yell at the husband or the brother or the uncle or the grandfather.
Often when children do come forward and try to trust someone and tell them what is happening, they're turned away or disbelieved.
And Tracy, as we've said already, you know, this is such a taboo topic. It's really not that widely discussed. We almost don't have the language to discuss stuff that's just so horrible. Is there any sense that that might be changing slowly, though?
Well, it used to also be the case when it came to institutional child abuse, but we had this Royal Commission that really opened that up. It really opened a national conversation about what was happening inside institutions to children. And that's what we need to do with this. We need to start opening a conversation about incestuous child abuse within the home. And that's the only way we can really begin to deal with it and even understand what's going on. And this is actually something that Warwick Middleton is also really passionate about.
The Australian Royal Commission was sort of monumental in human history. No society has ever better conducted a commission of inquiry into something involving widespread child sexual abuse. They started with the premise of making the dignity of the survivors the number one priority. So they were respected, they were given dignity, they were empathically listened to. It would be nice at some point that Australia takes what it learned from the Royal Commission into institutional responses to child sexual abuse and goes the next step of actually better understanding what happens in families. If we can look at these other areas with the same level of respect and understanding and genuinely listen, I mean, who knows where it could all go.
And finally, Tracy, what about Annie? I mean, after all this horrendous, all these horrendous experiences in her childhood and her adolescence, how is she doing today?
Well, it took a lot of years of working through all of this, a lot of years of therapy and a support network. And part of that network was Warwick Middleton as her therapist. But there was also someone who was really significant to her who she met back in the group home. And his name was Daniel.
Thinking back to when you first met and where you were, where you both were actually at that point as teenagers, would you have ever thought that the life you have now would have been possible?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
And now Annie and Daniel are married and they have this beautiful 4-year-old daughter and they're determined to give her all the love and the care that they didn't have when they were growing up.
Are you going to go out somewhere with Daddy?
Yeah.
There is no greater feeling than having someone love you unconditionally the way that you were not loved. There's just no explanation for the feeling that they give back to you when your face is touched from their little hand where your mother slapped it so many times. And to be able to give that love to your own child that you craved so much. That's why I fought to give to someone else the love I did learn.
What advice would you give to women or young girls who are going through abuse and are coming out of that?
The bravest thing I can tell you is to try and say it. Try and let them see it. And if you can't say it, write it. If you can't write it, draw it. If you can't draw it, just try your hardest to show what's going on, to be able to put the pieces back together. Try and trust someone to help you. Give them the pieces.
That is The Signal for today and for this week. If today's episode has raised any issues for you, you can contact Lifeline. The number is 13 11 14. And if you need to speak to someone about sexual assault, you can call 1-800-RESPECT 24 hours a day. The number is 1-800-737-732. And over the weekend, can I also recommend our sister podcast, This Week with Linda Mottram. Linda is looking at electric cars, the latest breakthroughs on COVID treatments, and she has a fascinating interview exploring how a changing climate could affect Australian farmers. The podcast is called This Week. You can find it in the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. And I will be back here with another episode of The Signal at the same time on Monday.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.